Hi, you're listening to NPR on Science. I'm Joe Palca, a correspondent here on the Science Desk at NPR. In today's podcast, we've got news from Mars. If you're planning a visit, be sure to take some ice skates. There's also a sobering story about just how hard it will be to reduce our energy use. Then we've got an interesting story about how it may be possible for the adult brain to recover functions that seem to be lost forever. But to kick things off, Robert Krulwich has a story about, well, I'm not going to tell you what the story is about. I'm going to sing to you about what the story is about. Oh, I wish I was a little mosquito. Wish I was a little mosquito. I'd slippy and I'd slidey under everybody's nighty. Oh, I wish I was a little mosquito. Okay, that's quite enough of that. Let's hear what Robert Krulwich has to say about the mosquito.
Yes, they are irritating. Very, very irritating. There's so many of them carrying God knows what diseases.
Well, there's a whole list of diseases. They transmit. They can transmit malaria, yellow fever, dengue, encephalitis, filariasis. Yeah.
And so I asked David Quammen, a well-known science writer who's well aware of the suffering the mosquitoes can cause, is there anything nice that we can say about mosquitoes? Anything at all? And David is a very kind guy.
I was sitting in the backyard this morning, and a mosquito came flying by, and I found that I didn't have the heart to swat her. I shooed her away, and she came back about four times. Just didn't have it in me to squash her.
Because, as it happens, in an essay he wrote more than 20 years ago, David proposed three nice things to say about mosquitoes, things I did not know, like...
50% of all mosquitoes that are flying around are completely harmless.
Because 50% of all mosquitoes are guys. And, says David...
My understanding is that the guys don't bite.
So every time you go... You're slapping a lady?
Almost certainly, because the male mosquito has no reason whatsoever to land on you.
Well, then, but who do the male mosquitoes land on? Is it flowers?
The guys are doing what guys do. They're looking for females.
Uh-huh.
They're looking for sex. And the females, yes, they want sex, but they also want blood.
And they want blood because mosquitoes are wonderful mommies. They need protein to feed their babies. And how many babies do they feed?
Oh, let's see. I think roughly 200 in a clutch. And in the course of a reasonable summer, I think that they can produce about 10 clutches, about 2,000.
2,000 babies. So that means you have to have a lot of protein if you're going to build 2,000 babies, don't you think? Which is why lady mosquitoes are so good at finding warm mammals to feed on. How they do it, nobody's sure, but one guess is they can sense body heat, which brings us to an old Italian folktale.
That if you slept with a pig in the bedroom, it would offer you some protection against mosquitoes. And the reason for that, I think, was that the pig was operating at a higher body temperature, you know, say 101 or 102 degrees Fahrenheit instead of 98.6.
So the mosquito then zips right by you and heads right for the pig.
Yes, that apparently was the concept.
Now we have
mosquito nets and screened windows.
The point is they're so good at finding warm bodies, they've been biting us for hundreds of thousands of years, which leads to perhaps their single greatest achievement, says David.
So when we emerged as a species and then started moving around, we plowed the fields and cut down the trees and created cities and agricultural landscapes.
But the hot, wet equatorial rainforests that are still host to more species and more variety of life than any other places on Earth, humans mostly avoided those places because if you entered a rainforest, chances are you'd get bit and then you'd get sick.
By way of malaria and dengue and yellow fever and some of these other diseases that I've mentioned.
So while most habitats have been invaded by humans, when it comes to tropical rainforests...
We didn't do that. Why didn't we? Well, one of the reasons, I'm convinced, is that mosquitoes were there standing guard, making those places
safe
difficult.
For all the butterflies and the bugs and the lovely leaves. I can hear the music now building in the background.
There it is. I can hear it too.
The lady mosquito, fiercely protecting beetles and orchids, ferns, butterflies, biting mankind to save the last true wildernesses on Earth. Nature's hero, the lady mosquito, we thank you. So, one, the boys don't bite. Two, the ladies make great mommies, great providers. And three, mosquitoes defend the Earth's rainforests. That's your essential argument.
That's my essential argument. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
I'm Robert Krulwich, NPR News.
Another summer annoyance is high electricity bills. They tend to soar in summertime as everybody goes to the AC and cranks it up to cool things down. Now, air conditioning may cool us off, but running all those air conditioners are helping to heat up this poor old planet we all live on. That's because most of the electricity for running those fans and compressors comes from power plants that burn fossil fuels. It's pretty clear we're going to have to do something about reducing our carbon footprint if we want to slow global warming. It's often said that the cheapest and most painless way to do this is to use energy more efficiently. But there's a huge gap between what's theoretically possible and what happens in real life. That's a problem for more than a dozen states who are now promising to make big and quick cuts in energy use. My colleague Richard Harris lives in Maryland, for example, and his home state is trying to slash electric use by 15% in the next 7 years. Here's his report.
To find out why there's such a huge gap between theory and practice, I turn to Michael Dworkin. He's been involved in one of the most sustained and successful state programs, Vermont's. Part of the reason, he says, is electricity is still pretty cheap.
Even high energy bills are typically only 2-4% of a household's discretionary income. You know, they're a third of what they spend on health care, they're a third of what they spend on the car, they're a quarter of what they spend on housing.
For example, a 15% cut in my electric bill would save me $24 a month, less than I spend on coffee. Prices are climbing as fossil fuels get more expensive, but Dworkin says it doesn't make sense to wait for the pain of higher bills.
Efficiency is by far the better choice.
I got some inkling into why people aren't jumping at chances to save energy and money by hanging out at my local hardware store. On Earth Day, the local utility was giving away compact fluorescent light bulbs, CFLs. The CFLs were also on the shelves for a heavily subsidized price. Harry Jaeger from Southern Maryland picked up an armful.
Why are you buying a bunch of bulbs today?
Oh, because they're only 99 cents. And everyone says the CFLs are always expensive. So since they're 99 cents, we decided to go for a few.
Huh. How many do you have in your house right now?
None, which is why we're buying some.
Right. Where are you planning to put them?
I'm not sure yet. We'll figure out what burns out first in the house, and that's where we'll go.
This brief conversation revealed a lot about the challenges of promoting energy efficiency. First off, Jaeger had no idea he could have saved a lot on his electric bills even if he'd bought CFLs for $5 or $10 apiece. Each bulb saves $12 a year, assuming it's in a lamp that's on a lot. So even now, Jaeger is wasting money by waiting for his old bulbs to burn out. And if it's hard to get people to spend a few dollars on light bulbs, consider the challenge of getting them to spend hundreds or even thousands of dollars on insulation or energy-saving appliances. I talked about this conundrum with Malcolm Wolf. It's his job as the head of the Maryland Energy Administration to get the state to its ambitious goal.
We know that we can give people incentives to buy energy-efficient appliances, to make their building envelope more efficient, to reduce their consumption by putting in energy-efficient light bulbs and technologies.
But incentives like appliance rebates or subsidized light bulbs aren't going to get Maryland anywhere close to its 15% goal. And here's why. Even if people are willing to spend money up front to do their part for climate change, it's not obvious how to spend that money. Buy a new fridge? Maybe, maybe not. Put in new windows? Very pricey. Add insulation? Well, that's likely to pay off, but how quickly will you recoup that investment? Malcolm Wolf says Maryland hopes to overcome these problems by training thousands of people to become home energy contractors.
They can come in, they can tell me how to improve my house, and then they can actually do the work.
Conceptually, it makes a lot of sense, but is it really going to pay for me to spend $250 to $500 to have one of these guys come in and tell me that maybe I need another $500 worth of work or more to my house? I have no sense of whether that's ever going to pay for itself.
That's exactly the challenge, is these are investments that do make sense. They will reduce your bill. You will get your money back over a period of months and years.
You just have to take that on faith. There's no knowing what your potential savings are until you've spent the money to find out. And Wolf knows not everyone can afford to take that plunge.
And a lot of us are struggling to simply, you know, pay that month's bill and can't make the investments over the long term.
Maryland still has to figure out how to get people over that big financial hump, and that points to a deeper problem. Michael Dworkin from the Vermont Law School says it's not just individuals who have to think differently. So do state governments. What really worked in Vermont, he says, was the state created a system of financial incentives to make the program fly.
You have to give somebody a stake in the game. You need to have an institution that benefits by doing it well and that suffers by doing it badly.
Maybe with the right incentives, someone will invent new financial instruments that will make it easy for people to have home energy audits. And maybe they'll figure out how to stir most of Maryland's 5 million-plus residents to action, even though only about half of the U.S. population is really concerned about global warming. But so far, the state of Maryland isn't following Dworkin's advice. It's simply asked the local utilities to come up with energy conservation plans. The utilities have no financial stake in the success or failure of those plans. And, by the way, the plans as currently written don't get close to reaching the Maryland goals.
It makes sense to have a goal if you're willing to tie impacts to it and results and responsibility for it. Declaring a goal with no responsibility is a waste of time for everybody.
Dworkin says Vermont set realistic goals and it's meeting them. But the goals are much less ambitious than those set forth in Maryland, or California, New Jersey, New York, and Massachusetts, to name a few. Malcolm Wolf at the Maryland Energy Administration admits the state is trying to bite off a lot with its new law.
This is an aspirational goal. We want to achieve 15%. If we're successful, we think it's the same as avoiding three new power plants. We'll save the state almost $6 billion. Some outside groups have estimated that it'll create over 8,000 green-collar jobs. If, in fact, we fall a little short and we've only reduced consumption 12% and it only creates 7,000 jobs and avoids two power plants, I think that is a victory for consumers in Maryland.
The potential benefits are not just for consumers, of course. Michael Dworkin says successful conservation programs strike at the heart of climate change. Nationwide, electricity is responsible for 40% of carbon emissions.
Anything that saves on the electric front has a very direct effect on our carbon emissions. And as we look at the commitments that are being made in more than half the states right now for people to say, we will get our carbon emissions under control within a decade, what that really means is we will get our electric demand under control within a decade.
And success, unfortunately, is not just reaching a 15 or 20% reduction. If Maryland reaches its goal, for example, that only reduces carbon emissions by 4% overall, when you factor in trucks and cars, heating fuels, and population growth. Conservation may be the cheapest way to address climate change, but that's not to say it's easy. Richard Harris, NPR News.
Next up, we have a story I did about amblyopia, sometimes called lazy eye. It's a condition where the brain has trouble processing images from both eyes simultaneously, so one eye stops working so well. The news here is that some Canadian researchers think they may be on to a new way of treating people with amblyopia. About 2 or 3% of children born in this country suffer from amblyopia. Frequently, the condition is caused when one of their eyes is out of alignment when they're born. Surgery can correct the pointing problem, but
they still won't recover vision in that eye because the underlying neural processing of information from that eye has developed abnormally.
Benjamin Thompson is with McGill Vision Research at the Royal Victoria Hospital in Montreal. It's not that children with amblyopia go blind in one eye.
When you cover their good eye, they can see through their amblyopic eye, and depending on the depth of amblyopia, they can sometimes see reasonably or hardly at all.
Now remember, amblyopia is a brain problem. The eyes work okay. It's the brain that's having trouble processing the signals from the eye. Treatment for amblyopia frequently involves wearing a patch over the good eye to force the brain to use the bad eye. That treatment might continue until a child is 10 or so.
But after that, it's thought that really you don't have the ability to change in the brain that would allow you to recover function in the eye.
So to help adult amblyopes, Thompson and his colleagues tried a new approach called transcranial magnetic stimulation, or TMS. Basically, it involves putting an electrical coil against the scalp.
And a very brief magnetic pulse is induced in the coil, and that sets up a very brief electrical current in the underlying cortex.
Thompson applied a series of pulses called repetitive TMS, or RTMS, to the scalps of amblyopes.
We could improve the vision in the amblyopic eye after just 15 minutes of RTMS.
It's not clear why magnetic stimulation is improving vision, and the improvement was modest, and it only involved the ability to see contrasting lines, not stereo vision. But the improvement did come in adult subjects, showing it may be possible to teach old brains new tricks. The work appears in the journal Current Biology. Don't get the idea that any revolution in amblyopia treatment is imminent. Lynn Kiorpes is a vision researcher at New York University. She points out that the Canadian study involved only 9 subjects, and only one of the subjects showed substantial improvement. Still, it's possible the effect is real.
It is conceivable that this procedure, in combination with some other kind of vision training, could effect a long-term change.
Kiorpes' NYU colleague Anthony Movshan is also skeptical about how useful magnetic pulses will be. He's more impressed with an experimental therapy called perceptual learning, where adult amblyopes are given a kind of visual exercise regimen to stretch their brains. He's not clear how magnetic stimulation would help with that.
It's very hard to imagine that whatever goes on in perceptual learning, which is probably a slow cumulative process, can be simulated or mimicked by simply whacking the brain with a few magnetic pulses.
But Eric Wasserman sees more promise in the Canadian results. Wasserman is at the Neurology Institute at the National Institutes of Health. He's been working with magnetic brain stimulation for years. He says it can wake up portions of the brain that for some reason have become dormant.
It's a useful tool for this sort of demonstration because it's very safe and we don't have to open people's heads in order to apply it.
He says magnetic stimulation may yet become a valuable tool for treating amblyopia. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington. Now, you know, Tony Movshan heard that piece. He was one of the scientists I talked to, and he got in touch with me afterwards and thought I was too easy on these Canadian scientists. He really didn't think that their report was very convincing and the data wasn't very strong. As you heard Lynn Kiorpes say, there was only one subject who really pushed the data toward a conclusion that would be significant. You know, but at the same time, I have to tell you, I talked to some scientists, or some optometrists anyway, in Texas who were very excited about this and thought it might be useful, and then they were planning to test this equipment. So, you know, I guess you'd have to say, we'll see. Basic scientists weren't totally impressed. Optometrists, maybe more so. We'll see. Finally, there's this little piece I did about the Mars Phoenix lander and what it's doing on Mars. Scientists sent Phoenix to a landing site near the North Pole on Mars because they knew, I mean, they just knew for certain that there would be water in the region. They'd seen satellite data from a satellite around Mars that showed there was water, and, you know, it was certain that there would be water there, but not liquid water. It would be too cold at the pole. It would be ice water. So they knew the water was there, but the Phoenix scientists wanted to prove it. And to do that, they had to get a sample into one of their instruments, and that turned out to be trickier than they expected. In the past 2 months, the Phoenix lander has sampled the Martian soil, measured the Martian weather, and snapped thousands of pictures of the Martian countryside. The scoop at the end of the robotic arm has exposed white stuff that looks like water ice and acts like water ice, but to prove it's water ice, mission managers wanted to scoop some of the stuff into the TIGA, an onboard instrument that would analyze it. Phoenix project manager Barry Goldstein says they could get the white stuff into their scoop, but then there was a problem.
It's clumpy. Very clumpy.
So clumpy, it would stick to the bottom of the scoop.
No matter how hard we tried, we couldn't shake it free of the scoop and get it delivered into the TIGA.
So mission managers changed tactics. They had the lander scoop up drier soil and deliver that to the TIGA. To their delight, even though the sample appeared dry, the TIGA instrument showed it contained water. Peter Smith is Phoenix principal scientist.
Our excitement is not so much that ice is made of H2O, it's what we're going to learn about the impurities that are associated with this ice, salts, minerals, and all of the things that are going to tell us about the history and the chance that this is a habitable zone on Mars.
Meaning maybe there was once life here. Smith says if Mars were once a warmer planet, maybe some of this ice near the North Pole was once liquid. And there's plenty of ice near the Phoenix landing site. Smith says you only have to scrape away 2 inches of dirt to see it.
If you had a broom, you could actually make a skating rink here. It's really amazing.
I was going to think you should have sent up a Zamboni machine.
Well, we should have, yes. Maybe the next mission will think to do that.
Actually, the next mission will send another rover to Mars. No Zamboni. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington. That's all for this edition of NPR's On Science. I'm Joe Palca in Washington.